So again, we're in Hebrews chapter 11, beginning in verse 17, and just continuing our study of chapter 11. Chapter 11 is again referred to as the Hall of Faith. We hear about all these, reminded about all these great historic figures from the Old Testament who were heroes of our faith, you know, heroes because of their faith and how they inspire us. And so we're going to look at some different people today, but first we're going to get yet another look at Abraham, who, you know, of course, is referred to as the father of faith. So Hebrews 11, verse 17 says, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, 'In Isaac your descendants shall be called.'" Now, you might remember back in Genesis, God told Abraham one day he wanted him to offer up his son. I'll read that. It's from Genesis 22, verse 2. Genesis 22, verse 2, God here says to Abraham, "Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you." And we've talked at length already in our study of Hebrews of how Abraham was actually 100 years old when Isaac was born. So, you know, this sacrifice is a real sacrifice because, like, ain't going to be another one coming after this, you know. He was already 100 when the child was born. The child was a teenager at this point. So he would have been, you know, 115 or so. But unbelievably, God is asking Abraham to do this, to sacrifice Isaac, his only son. But in Genesis, when you actually read all that account, I'm not going to spend a lot of time there. I'm not going to go back there today. You don't see any hesitation on Abraham's part. He's like, okay, I'll just get ready and this is what we're going to do. And he goes out. It's a three-day hike for them to get to this Moriah, land of Moriah. And Abraham proceeds right up through the point of, you know, binding his son and raising a knife. You know, like he's actually going to, you know, kill his son. And of course, God calls out to him to stop. You know, don't do what he's about to do. And that's because, you know, God doesn't condone human sacrifice. You know, God never condones that. In fact, our verse in Hebrews tells us such because it says Abraham was tested there. And that was the whole point. It was just a test of Abraham to see where his heart was. You know, did he value this child more than he valued obeying God? But we kind of gain some understanding of why Abraham was so confident to do this as we read our next verse in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11:19 says of Abraham, "He considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type." And so Abraham just has incredible faith. I mean, really, I mean, it's amazing to us. He was having faith that even if I kill my son, well, God will just resurrect him. I mean, that's like, wow, you know, what faith to believe that. Now, Abraham lived in approximately 2000 BC, so about 4,000 years ago was when Abraham was alive on the earth. And that's well before the first resurrection ever took place in the Bible. If my recollection is correct, the first resurrection was performed through Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 20 there. And that was between 800 and 900 BC. So that's like 1,000 years later, you know, that this first resurrection actually happened. So when Abraham is believing this, he's believing God for a resurrection, he didn't have any like history to call on. It's like, oh, you know, God does this. You know, he kills the child and raises the child again. You know, he didn't have any history like that to draw on. He just, you know, had this faith that God would do that because it had never happened before and again wouldn't happen for 1,000 years. But what Abraham did have was God's promise to him. And we caught that in verse 18 of Hebrews 11. Where it said, "In Isaac your descendants shall be called." God had promised him these descendants, and through Isaac, more specifically. And Abraham also had the experience of having walked with God as long as he had. I mean, he's over 100 years old now. He had waited, like we've talked about in previous studies, 25 years for the birth of Isaac to occur, and then finally saw God miraculously do it. You know, a 100-year-old man and a 90-year-old woman had their first baby ever. That's amazing that that took place. And, you know, most of us are probably frustrated at how slow we are to believe. You know, we see that as believers, if you're a believer today, that, you know, we struggle with that. Like, we want to trust God more than we do, and we wrestle with that. But over time, just like Abraham here, we're going to grow in our confidence to believe in God, to believe that God's going to come through. You know, the longer we walk with Him, the more we see Him faithful in our lives, the more we're going to trust Him. One way I found that can really help with this is to keep a journal, or, you know, you may nowadays have a blog or whatever, you know, you want to do. If you want to have it on your phone, however, it's cool. And in that journal, you write down, you know, specifically answers to prayer and really just any kind of God sighting in your life. You know, like, I really, the Lord was moving in this way and led me to do this, and this is what happened. You know, writing down these kinds of things. And then in the future, you know, when we find ourselves discouraged or we've got some new challenge ahead of us, we can look back and see how God provided in the past. And it's so encouraging at that time. It really can bolster your faith in the current situation, you know, because you, whenever something comes up, you always think this is the worst thing that's ever happened, you know. But then you look in your journal and go, wait, I thought that, you know, 2 years ago, that was the worst thing that ever happened. And God took care of me, you know. So God's going to take care of me now as well. And I think that's what's most important about Abraham, is Abraham had faith. He looked at his circumstances, and he knew that God had said that Isaac would be the one through whom he would fulfill the promise. You know, what the one of the verses that quotes that is in Genesis 21, verse 12. That's one place that mentions that. It says, God spoke there and said, through Isaac your descendants shall be named, just like what we read here in Hebrews. Therefore, you know, if it was going to be through Isaac, Abraham has to reason the only way God could do that is he's going to have to bring Isaac back. That's the only way. You know, Isaac can't be dead and have children of his own. He's got to be alive in this world. And so I love how Abraham reasoned from a place of faith like this. And I think Abraham demonstrates for us a right use of the ability to reason and the reasoning that God's equipped every person with. You know, reasoning is not the enemy of faith, as, you know, many like to think today. You know, many people suggest that you know, reason and faith are kind of at war with each other. You hear that a lot, you know, on the media or something like this. But rather than them being at war, you know, really much of what we call reason today had its origins in the Christian faith. I mean, you think about, for example, the scientific method that's based on the premise that there is order in the universe. And when you look at some of the greats of science past, like, you know, Isaac Newton, who gave us, like, you know, most of, you know, much of physics and calculus and all this stuff that is really hard to learn and we all hate it, you know, if you have to take it at some point. But it's really awesome stuff. Well, he based this premise of the scientific method was based on the fact that he and others knew there was a God of order in the universe, and they saw that God of order in the Bible, you know, as believers themselves. And so that's where that basis is. As believers then, you know, we should reason from our faith as well, like Abraham did, drawing on the character of God that we see in the scriptures and, you know, just the God we've come to know in our walk with Him, how we've seen Him faithful in our lives. God is trustworthy, and those things that He's promised us, He's going to do those things. Now, there are times that we, you know, kind of put words in God's mouth, as it were, believing Him for things that He never promised that He would do, you know, and we do that because there are things that we would like to see, things that we would hope to see. For those things, though, we can't expect God, you know, to work there. You know, He's not a genie in the bottle that every time we want something, He's going to be obligated to do it. He's only going to do those things that He's promised. But where there is a clear promise, there's going to be action, just like Abraham was believing in here. So we've looked at Abraham. Let's look at Isaac next in verse 20. Verse 20 says, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. And I think Isaac is kind of interesting. I think he's an example of us having faith in the sovereignty of God, that God is sovereign over the things in our lives and in this world. God had told Rebekah before she gave birth to Jacob and Esau that the younger would rule the older. That was in Genesis 25. Verse 23. Remember that it says there are these two nations warring in her stomach. She's like, why am I having all this, you know, battle in my womb, you know? And it's like, well, there are these two nations, and the younger one is actually going to, you know, be stronger than the older one, even though they were twins. And so he was born, you know, just a little bit later. And so, you know, Jacob was that younger one, and Esau was the older. But when Isaac was old, and it was time for him to pass on his blessing, as they would do, they'd pass on a blessing to their sons. And one of them would get an extra blessing, like a double portion of the inheritance. Well, Isaac, you know, planned to give it to Esau as the older. And Esau was his favorite, too. I mean, Esau was a hunter, kind of like the man's man. You know, and Jacob was kind of a little wimpy guy, you know. So he really liked Esau better, you know. That was the guy he bonded with more. And so even though God had said, you know, the younger one is the one who should get the double blessing, he was going to give it to Esau anyway. So a little bit of disobedience on Isaac's part there. But if you remember the story, his wife Rebekah, you know, kind of caught wind of this, and she and Jacob tricked him into giving the blessing to Jacob. You know, he wore kind of a costume and stuff like this and put scent on him so he would smell like his brother and all this sort of thing. And his father, who couldn't see at that point, thought he was blessing, you know, the right one. He said, well, you smell like him, you feel like him, but you sound like, you know, Jacob, you know. But he ends up blessing him. And here in Hebrews, it's implied that in these blessings then, that Isaac basically said, you know, trusted in the end that, well, this was God's will. You know, it wasn't what he wanted, but this was God's will. And so he trusted in God's sovereignty here. And I think we find ourselves in this place also. You know, sometimes we have an idea of what we think is God's will, but things go different than we expect. I mean, how often does that happen? I know it's happened many times in my life. But, you know, as these things unfold, then we just have to trust, well, I guess this was God's will. You know, I thought it was going to be this other thing, but I guess this was God's will. And so often, then we find out eventually why. You know, we say, well, God actually had a better plan here. You know, actually, it didn't look so great to me on the front end, but now on the back end, I see I'm so glad that, you know, God directed things in this way rather than what I had in mind. Well, next let's read about Jacob in verse 21. Verse 21 says, by faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. And Jacob, I think, here is an example of really that faith on the mountaintop. You know, that's what we all love, is the faith on the mountaintop, when everything's going great. That's what we really enjoy the most. Here he is at the end of his life, and he's blessing the children of Joseph. Now, Joseph was Jacob's, you know, favorite child. And Jacob did something that we're never supposed to do and have a favorite child. Now, I'm allowed to because I only have one child. But if you have more than one child, you know, you're not allowed to have a favorite. You know, that's a big no-no. And the kids knew that he was the favorite. And so that created a lot of jealousy. And so, you know, Joseph, his favorite, had been lost to Jacob to, he thought, a wild animal when Joseph was still a teenager. That happened in Genesis 37, verse 33. He didn't realize, though, his older sons, who were jealous of, you know, Joseph being the favorite, had actually taken him and sold him into slavery. I mean, terrible. I mean, talk about family problems, you know. I mean, this is like off the chart. Sold a brother into slavery, okay. And then told dad he was dead. You know, I mean, this is, you know, how horrible could it be? But now here Jacob is at the end of his life blessing Joseph's sons. And he actually adopted those sons as his own, we'll see. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 48. So hold a place in Hebrews. But we're going to read a few times from Genesis. So you might want to kind of stick something in there too. Genesis 48 verse 11 is the first verse we'll look at that kind of goes along with what we've been saying. Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face. And behold, God has let me see your children as well. And so you get a sense for just how overjoyed he is there. And what happens in all this in Genesis 48, we understand, is that, again, Jacob kind of takes Joseph's sons as his own. He sort of adopts them right here because he ends up blessing Joseph's sons. And through this, Joseph actually is receiving a double portion, really, of the blessing that Israel had. And I'll use Israel and Jacob interchangeably because he has those two names. And so with Joseph's two sons taking his place, that's how we formed the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, you might remember that these two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, are two of the 12 tribes of Israel. And, you know, nothing builds our faith like seeing God move in our lives. I think probably if you've been a believer very long, you've experienced that. You see, an answered prayer, you know, perhaps, is one way that it happens. Or an unexpected blessing, like what Jacob was experiencing right here. Other times, you know, just you're in God's Word and you hear Him really speak to your situation through His Word. And that just really bolsters our faith. These and other ways, you know, do that. There are other ways that God can work in our lives as well. But when He does something like that, it just re-energizes our faith and fills our hearts with worship, like Jacob's heart was full of worship here. And so Jacob, you know, had faith on the mountaintop. And again, we loved being on the mountaintop. We never want to come down. But Jacob also, not only did he have faith, but he also expressed his faith here. He expressed it in the blessing of Joseph's sons. Let's read a little more in Genesis 48, verse 17. It says, "When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on Ephraim's head, it displeased him, and he grasped his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to his father, 'Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Place your right hand on his head.' But his father refused and said, 'I know, my son, I know. He also will become a people, and he will be great. However, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations.' He blessed them that day, saying, 'But you, Israel, will pronounce blessings, saying, May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh.' Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh." And so again, you can hold your place in Genesis there. I'll read some more from Genesis in a little bit. And we'd already seen how Jacob was kind of moving in faith here by giving this double honor to Joseph, you know, one of his younger sons, giving him that extra blessing by adopting his two children. But now in faith, he's doing it again. He's giving the greater blessing of those two men to Ephraim, who's not the firstborn. Again, you know, the firstborn is supposed to be the one that gets the better blessing, or gets the double blessing or whatever. But he's saying, no, it goes to Ephraim, not to Manasseh. Now, you know, cynically, we might look at this and say, well, you know, isn't he just kind of stealing the blessing from Manasseh like he had stole it from Esau himself? Jacob is the one who stole the blessing from his brother Esau, and he was the younger himself. So you might say, well, he's just doing the same thing. You know, he's blessing the younger, kind of a little spite there at the end, you know, to the end of his life. That it was kind of a fleshly decision and not a spiritual decision. But that's actually not the case. He was really doing this in faith, prophesying of what God would do in the lives of these men. Because as we look historically, Ephraim's nation was the more prominent nation. You might remember that Joshua was the person who actually led the people into the promised land after the Exodus. You know, Moses wasn't allowed to go in because he sinned. And so instead, Joshua takes them into the promised land. Well, Joshua is of the line of Ephraim. He was a descendant of Ephraim. And then when later on in history, when the nation of Israel has kind of a civil war, it divides into two. The northern land, there was the northern land of Israel, that was like 10 tribes, and then there was the southern tribe of Judah, and Ephraim became the dominant tribe of the north. They were like the dominant ruling party of the north. Even before the split, though, you might remember that Rehoboam, who was the son of Solomon, he is the king who was basically the reason for the split of the nation into two kingdoms. Well, for his inauguration as king, he was going up into Ephraim also. He went up to Shechem in Ephraim. He didn't get, you know, inaugurated in Jerusalem where you would expect. He went up into you know, the land of Ephraim to be inaugurated. Now, the inauguration kind of blew up in his face. His nation splits in half and he has to run for his life. You know, not exactly what he had in mind. And all that takes place in 1 Kings chapter 12. But again, after that split, Ephraim is now the dominant party of the northern kingdom. And such that, you know, in the Bible, we'll find that Ephraim is actually used as a synonym for the northern kingdom. Isaiah 11, verse 13 talks about this as an example. Isaiah 11, 13 is talking about these two kingdoms that Israel split into. It says, "Then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart, and those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim." So again, it's talking about those two splits of the nation, kind of like two quarreling brothers or something. And so just like Jacob prophesied, Ephraim, the younger, became greater than the older, than Manasseh's tribe. And, you know, that was revealed by God to Jacob, really in faith there. I mean, that's all we can assume, that just God put that on his heart right then and there. And Jacob believed God for it. And, you know, sometimes in our lives, God puts something on our heart. And we can struggle to believe it. We can struggle to believe that this is really, you know, what I'm hearing is what I'm hearing. But those things that God shows us, those things that we can test according to his word, we need to pray for boldness to believe those things. You know, to believe what God is leading us in. Just like Jacob did here. Back in Hebrews, I'm going to turn back to Hebrews. I'm not going to turn back to Genesis, but you might want to leave a mark there because I am going to read a few more passages out of Genesis if you like to follow along with those. But for now, back in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 22, there are some more examples of faith through these faithful Old Testament characters. In verse 22, we're going to get a look at Joseph. So verse 22 says, "By faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones." Now, we're not surprised at all to find Joseph in the Hall of Faith. I mean, Joseph is like, if there is a clear hero in the Old Testament, it is Joseph, right? He's an amazing person. And his life actually mirrors that of Christ in many ways. I don't know if you are familiar with that. I'll give a few that I'm aware of. First of all, Joseph was, like we talked about earlier, he's the one sold into slavery, for our memory there. He was rejected by his own. You know, his brothers, again, sold him into slavery. He was then falsely accused and arrested by a foreign nation. You know, Jesus, obviously, was under the Romans. For Joseph, it was due to Potiphar. You know, Potiphar's wife accused him of adultery. And when he rejected her advances, and so he got thrown in prison for that because they said, "Oh, she said you did it, so you did it." You know, so he got thrown in prison for that. He was therefore being in prison, publicly humiliated before he was ultimately exalted, just like what happened to Jesus. And Joseph also brought salvation. Now, his salvation was not eternal salvation. He brought salvation from the famine that was going on in the land. And he brought that salvation even to some that betrayed him. You know, Jesus, when Jesus was going through his trial and through the crucifixion, all that, his disciples, you know, remember, they basically split. You know, they were scared. And so you could say they betrayed him at that point. And just like Joseph's brothers betrayed him, you know, by selling him into slavery. And yet, ultimately, Joseph brought salvation for them. They all end up coming to Egypt, and he provides for them. So again, it's just Joseph is amazing in all that God did through him and in the fact that God actually preserved the nation of Israel through him ultimately at that time. He went from being a slave in Egypt to becoming a prime minister of Egypt, or the prime minister of Egypt. You know, no one was more powerful than him except for Pharaoh. It's just amazing. And again, provided for the salvation of so many. But the author chose here to highlight the fact that, you know, he had faith regarding his burial place. And he used that as an example of Joseph's faith. Now, we probably would have chosen his faith in God again when he was sold into slavery. When that happened, and you read through the passages in Genesis, we never hear him angry at God in Egypt. We never hear him shaking his fist and saying, "Well, this is what I got. This is what I got for following God," or whatever. He never does anything like that. You know, he's faithful to the Lord. In fact, he makes this famous statement to his brothers once his brothers and he are reunited in Egypt. In Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, I'll read it. If you're still there, you might want to look at it. But Genesis 50, verse 20 and following says, "As for you," meaning his brothers, "you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And, you know, when Joseph refused Potiphar's wife's advances and he gets thrown into prison, he doesn't get bitter at God. He doesn't get angry at God over what's happened to him. In fact, instead of that, he's given a leadership position there in the prison. And that happened in Genesis 39, verse 21, that, you know, he had favor with the warden, and the warden actually makes him, you know, kind of a leader over everyone else there in the prison. But the author in Hebrews reminds us that even though all this happened, ultimately Joseph died in Egypt. You know, he didn't get to go back to the promised land. He died in Egypt. But before he died, he gave those instructions about his burial in Israel. And that's because Joseph, again, had faith. He had faith to believe that Israel would return to its inherited land. In Genesis 50, verse 25, says that Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here." And so that's what this is talking about in Hebrews, is a reference to that. Joseph had come to Egypt as a teenager. We've talked about that. He lived basically his whole life there. He brought his extended family completely to Egypt. Humanly speaking, you'd have thought that, you know, this is our country now. You know, we're going to live in Egypt. You know, this is it. You know, we're never going back there. But Joseph, no doubt, remembered the promise that God had made to his forefathers. He made the promise to his father Jacob in Genesis chapter 28, verse 13. Genesis 28, 13, he made the promise to his grandfather Isaac in Genesis 26, verses 2 and following. And he made the promise to his great-grandfather Abraham in Genesis 17, verse 8. And all those promises were basically the same, that their land was going to be Israel. What we think of as Israel today, actually more than just what we think of as Israel today, but including that, that was their promised land. And so Joseph knew God was going to bring that to pass. He made those promises. He's going to make it happen. And so when the nation returns, actually does return, in the book of Joshua, we find his body was taken with them just as he requested. And that happened in Joshua 24, verse 32. Next, we're going to come to Moses. Back in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23 is where we'll see Moses, the beginning of our description of Moses here. And, you know, Moses has all kinds of examples of faith from his life. Again, I mean, I said Joseph is like the quintessential hero. I don't know. Maybe, you know, Joseph, Moses, I don't know. There's really going to be a difficult decision there, because he's another one, you know, huge player that God used in the Old Testament, just amazingly. And so from his life, we're going to look at three different categories here of times when we have faith. And the first category is faith to follow God under pressure. And so let's read from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23 and following. It says, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen." So, you know, Moses' first act of faith referenced here, Moses actually had no control over. He was a baby when it took place. Because, you know, at the time of his birth in Egypt, if you're not familiar, don't remember this, there was a standing order given by the Pharaoh. And I'll read that from Exodus chapter 1, verse 22. The Pharaoh commanded in Exodus 1:22, kind of in the middle of the verse, it says, "Every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive." So every male Israelite child that was born was to be killed. You know, throw them in the river, basically, is what's being told here. All the boys put to death. And Exodus 1 further explains it was due to Pharaoh's fear of the Israelites. He saw that they were, like, really growing in number, and, like, their men were, like, really buff, you know? So he's like, they could eventually overtake us, you know? So he was scared. So he's like, we got to get rid of the men, you know, to start killing off the men so they can't possibly do this. But Moses' parents, we read in Hebrews, hid him to keep him alive. And so clearly they were disobeying the government in favor of God's edict not to murder. I mean, because Pharaoh was the one that gave the command and said they weren't afraid of him. You know, they were going to do instead what was right in God's eyes. Because, you know, God's command not to murder didn't just come into being at the giving of the law, which ironically Moses was the one who God used to give that law. But previously in Genesis 9 verse 6, God had said that whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. So way back at the beginning, God has always said murder is wrong, you know, to kill another human life. So in Hebrews, though, it points out the fact that he was, you know, Moses was this beautiful child. And that's, you know, a reason why they kept him around, if you will. They were also obeying God, whether they were purposeful in it or not. You know, whether they did it on purpose or not, they were actually obeying this other edict not to murder. I tend to think that they were, even though the text tells us they saved him because he was a beautiful child. It's kind of interesting, too, that word beautiful that's there in the Greek is only used to describe Moses in the Bible. So it must have been really beautiful, you know. The other place it uses that word is in Acts 7, verse 20, also describing Moses. And I guess that's why when they made the movie The Ten Commandments, they picked Charlton Heston. You know, they needed a handsome character because this guy was so good looking, you know, that we had to keep him with us. So, but you remember how it also tells us that they could only keep him for about 3 months. And then, you know, the baby was getting large enough and maybe loud enough, you know, that they couldn't really keep him hidden anymore. And so his mother constructs this watertight basket and puts him in the basket in the reeds along the Nile. She didn't, like, throw him out in the middle where he would float and get caught up in the current. She actually just kind of put him on the shoreline, if you will, in the reeds, where he was then discovered by the daughter of Pharaoh, because that was a place where she would go to bathe there in the river. And so Moses ends up finding himself in Pharaoh's palace. And this is kind of ironic, really, because he's an Israelite man that Pharaoh was so afraid of, and he ends up living in Pharaoh's palace. It's kind of ironic, you know, how God worked this all out. But Moses, too, then, would follow God under pressure himself. In Hebrews 11, verse 24, there is what I'm referring to. There would have been, you know, kind of family pressure upon him, because he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. You know, she had adopted him as her own. But now when he got old enough and he could make his own decisions, he would not allow himself to be called that. Instead, he identified with his Israelite brothers and sisters. You can imagine that there would have been pressure on him to live like an Egyptian. You know, I mean, he was raised in Pharaoh's palace. If only out of gratitude, you know, that he would do that. I mean, look, we got you to this point, and how can you, you know, be so ungrateful now that you won't live like an Egyptian? But that would have been idolatry for him, you know, for him to obey his adoptive mother over the Lord, you know, obeying her instead of God. And that is a difficult thing, you know, to have someone like that, you know, which we assume he had some feeling for her, that he probably loved her as his adoptive mother. Or, you know, someone in authority over us, you know, that can happen in our lives too, that's pressuring us in a way that's away from God instead of towards God. But Moses chose the right path. You know, he sided with the people of God. And he sided with holiness, is really what our text in Hebrews implies too. Rather than siding with the Israel of Israel's enemy, excuse me, and sinful pleasures, as it also says. Well, the next category then that we see in the life of Moses is faith to follow God when it doesn't make sense. And that we saw in verse 28. Let me read verse 28, actually. It says, "By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them." So, you know, we're getting a lot of history today. Hopefully that's interesting to you, not putting you to sleep. But we'll press on here. Remember, at the first Passover, God gave instructions regarding the blood of an unblemished lamb. That unblemished lamb was to be used for the meal. It was like the sacrifice for the meal. But then they were supposed to take the blood of that. And it says in Exodus 12, verse 7, "They shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it." So they're supposed to take this blood and use it like paint, you know, around the top of the door, sort of. Now, you know, most of us are probably familiar with this story. And we know that, you know, from Hebrews 9, verse 22, that we studied a few weeks ago, that sin is only covered by blood. And you can read more about that if you read that passage yourself, or you can actually listen to the Bible study we did on that a few weeks ago that talks more about that. And we know this, the blood on the doorposts and the around the door kind of reminds us of Christ's sacrifice, that his blood was on a wooden cross for all of us. And so we read that and we kind of get it. We're like, yeah, it's the Passover. We know, we understand all that, all the symbolism and how God, what God was going to do, and God would see that and, you know, not strike anyone down in that house. But put yourself in Moses' shoes for a little bit. You know, that's a pretty amazing thing to believe, that I just put, you know, paint around the top of the door there and I'm good to go. You know, nothing's going to happen to me tonight. You know, this is a pretty amazing thing to believe. And in our lives, too, sometimes God asks us to believe him for things that don't make sense to us at the time. I think verse 30 offers another example of that. Verse 30 says, Hebrews 11, verse 30, "By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been circled for 7 days. You know, that was quite a battle plan. You know, let's just march around the city for 7 days and the walls will fall down. Yeah, that's what always happens when you march around a city, right? The walls fall down, of course. I mean, that's what always happens. Well, not usually, right? We wouldn't expect that. And yet that's exactly what happened as they follow God in faith there. And the cool thing about it is, you know, the place of Jericho, the site of Jericho, is well known today. It's been excavated. And yes, the walls were falling down just as the Bible describes. And we might have our own stories, you know, that we could add here. We're a place where God told us to do something and it didn't really make sense. You know, but we trusted him in faith for that. I remember when I first got out of school, I had a couple jobs I was looking at, a couple places I could go to work, and you know, I really felt like God was telling me to go work for this smaller company that offered less pay and more work, you know? And you're like, it doesn't really make sense, you know, why I would do that, you know? But I really, you know, it was the first time I think in my life, I really felt God telling me, you know, it was like, almost like an audible voice, like, you should do this, you know? So I took that job. And, you know, that led to a lifelong friend of mine in the Lord who worked at that small company. And you know how our careers work out. It kind of led to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. And that's why I'm here today. That's why I ended up moving to Texas, was through, you know, that chain, you know, that first job. That's how I discovered Calvary Chapel. I never heard of Calvary Chapel when I lived in Indiana. There was no Calvary Chapel where I lived, you know. And so I discovered that when I moved to the Austin area, that my family was here in Texas. I didn't know it was in the future. And now this church, you know, so you look at all those, that chain of events, you know, from one decision that didn't really make a whole lot of sense. You know, it didn't make sense to me at the time. It's like, okay, I'm going to trust the Lord here. And Moses also had a history like this to draw on of where God had led him. And it's like, okay, you know, it's going to happen because I know I've seen God work. This was the final of the 10 plagues. And so God had done all this amazing stuff already. And so Moses had all this faith built up to go, okay, whatever he says, I know it's going to happen. You know, so I have complete confidence. And all those experiences then equipped him for that. But faith in something that's unlikely is one thing. But what about faith to follow God into danger? And we kind of got a sense of that in We read over at Hebrews chapter 11, verse 27. Let me reread that. It says, "By faith he," that's Moses, "left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen." And then verse 29 also, speaking really of all of Israel at this point, says, "By faith they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned." Now, we're probably all familiar with the crossing of the Red Sea. It's been parodied, it's been done in movies. I mean, everyone knows about this amazing crossing at the Red Sea during the Exodus. You know, the Lord in that story, though, in that account, had led them actually into a dangerous situation, if you think about it. I mean, they had the Egyptians coming up on their heels behind them. They had freedom ahead of them. Oh, but wait a minute, there's this impassable sea in the way that they got to somehow get across. Actually, when you study the region, there were mountains on either side of them, too. They were kind of trapped, really, is where they were. But then God does this amazing miracle. Instead of mountains beside them, the next thing they have is these walls of water beside them, where they're able to cross on dry ground. You see all that unfold in Exodus 14. Verse 29 in particular is where it talks about the walls of water. And God just did a miracle there of splitting the sea like that. But God had led them there. And he actually led them there because he was going to deliver them there. He's going to deliver them from these Egyptians who were chasing them. You know, the Egyptians were coming after them. And, you know, what's the likelihood that the Egyptians were going to give up? You know, if Israel continued to somewhere else in the wilderness, they were just going to say, this is too far. You know, I'm hungry. Let's go home. You know, they're going to keep after them until they got them. That was their orders. And here's Israel. You know, they're not warriors. These are slaves. They were making bricks before this. You know, they're not, you know, seasoned warriors going to take on this Egyptian army that would have been like probably one of the most awesome, if not the most awesome army at the time. And so, humanly speaking, this was not a good match for Israel. This was not going to go well for them. But God would take care of this Egyptian army using the sea as a weapon, which is just incredible that God did that. And so Israel walks through on dry ground, but then the waters close in on Pharaoh's army and drowns them. And so, you know, why was Moses so bold in all this? I think verse 27 really is the answer to that, because it talks about how he saw him who is unseen. You know, he knew that God was mightier than Pharaoh and mightier than any army, you know, was his God. That's such an awesome verse. I love that verse. Another example of believing in a dangerous place we get in verse 31 from Rahab. Verse 31 says, "By faith Rahab, the harlot, did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace." And this is again back to Jericho, like verse 30 was. Rahab risked her lives to save the Hebrew spies who had come into Jericho to kind of check it out before they were going to battle with Jericho. And so, you know, she risked her life to save them, or they would have been killed themselves. Now, why does she do this? Well, Joshua chapter 2, verses 9 through 11, answers that for us. Joshua 2, verses 9 through 11, Rahab speaking here says to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath." And so we see that she believed in God, and God brought her through this dangerous time, and even placed her in the lineage of Christ. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 5, we see that. So when all of, you know, Jericho was destroyed, she and her family were spared in that dangerous time. Sometimes God takes us through dangerous places also. Not usually life-threatening, I hope, but he does take us through dangerous places. Perhaps God leads us out of a place of comfort into a place of risk, moving to a new city, taking on a new job or a new ministry, something like that. places where we have to trust Him in faith again. You know, we can't, in that place, we can't just ride on this wave of past successes because it's a new territory we're into. We're forging that new territory, and we have to be on our knees in prayer as a result. Trusting that place He's leading us to is going to be better, even though at the moment, all we might see around us is difficulty, you know, when we first take those first steps. But like for ancient Israel, the place of faith in God is the path to God's blessing. That's where God's blessing is found, walking in faith with Him. And so I would just like to exhort all of us, you know, based on what we've been reading and studying today, to live in that place of faith. Because like Moses and these others, we see the one who is unseen. Let's close with a word of prayer. Lord, we're just so inspired by these stories of faith and what You did in all these people's lives. God, we know You get all the glory, but they were willing in that, and they submitted to what Your plan was. And that's what we want in our lives too. We want to follow Your plan. We want to hear Your voice, listen, and follow. Help us to do that, God. We're imperfect people, but help us to hear and to understand and to follow You this week and throughout this year. We pray the rest of our lives, actually. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.